Welcome, welcome. We're back and we're doing things on people no one has ever heard of.
And at this point, it's kind of our specialty.
The Poor Niche Almanac. Welcome.
When you want someone to listen to a few of our episodes, you can say, check out our PNAs. Our PNAs, you might say.
Yes, and all of our episodes start like this, and I am sorry.
No, this is not the Poor Niche Almanac. This is the Poor Pearls Almanac. And if you're here, if you're new here, sorry, Andy's just like that.
It's true. So we are continuing our trajectory through the permanent agriculture movement that we've been covering basically since the 1800s. In the last few weeks, we've kind of talked about the major players in the Roosevelt administration and their attempts to kind of make permanent agriculture some part or a focal part of the American farming practice and kind of how that fell short. In that episode, we had brought up the name Russell Lord a few times as he was just kind of on the periphery and was still pretty closely tied to figures in that administration and was even a good friend of Vice President Henry Wallace. Now, today we're going to focus on him and his role in the movement, and in particular because he continued on pushing forward the whole permanent agriculture movement past World War II into the 50s, and then we're going to see in a few episodes how that affects other folks from the organic movement with Rodale, the Odom brothers, and permaculture, and how we see these different trajectories go from this moment, which is why it's really important to focus on this build-up to World War II and right after. By focusing on him, we can see how that trajectory happens. While we have talked about pretty niche figures so far on this show, this, I think, is the most niche so far. If you search Russell Lord, you know, put in quotes, add agriculture, add permanent agriculture, and so on, there's really not much that exists on the internet of him. There's no Wikipedia article, really nothing.
Not even a Wikipedia article. That's scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Yes, this is the nichest of the nichest trajectories that we're talking about here with Andy today. And I think it's safe to assume this person, Russell Lord, probably a descendant or has descended from the Caucasus Mountains, right?
He's pretty white, yes, if that's what you're saying. Like you said, Matt, he doesn't have a Wikipedia page. Basically, the only thing that exists with his name on it is a couple books that have been out of print for decades. That's about it. His primary role in all of this wasn't as a farmer, but as a writer. And his idea was that he would bring farmers to find permanent agriculture as not just a passing fad, but the natural scope of work for the farmer.
And for henceforth, on this podcast, we're going to be referring to it as the Lord's work, any of this body.
Yeah, I think the article "the" is the important part there, like Lord's work versus the Lord's work, maybe a capital letter or two. I don't know.
Every time I hear Lord without "the" in front of it, I think of like the singer.
Oh, interesting. Lord's work.
Royals. Yeah, totally different.
Just the discography.
Yeah. That is on Wikipedia, I bet.
You mean the only Lord's work that's won awards?
Mm-hmm.
And not started religious wars?
Well,
there's a lot of assimilation. No, not assimilation. What's the word for when something sounds similar repeatedly? Alliteration. That is it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of alliteration in that sentence, Elliot. I'm very proud of you.
And I'm pretty sure melodrama did start a war.
Did it? This Lord, what I find particularly important about his work is that he isn't just like a writer that just like talks about like, hey, like all these great things we can do with permanent agriculture, blah, blah, blah. What makes him particularly important, in my opinion, and why he does deserve to be platformed quite a bit more than he is that he would really argue for a lot of things that the eco-anarchist movement would discover like 50 years later. And basically, the premise of his entire position was that ecological problems are social problems.
Oh, so that's just going to be a thing this episode, huh?
So he's like Murray Bookchin without the insular fighting with everyone who slightly disagrees with him?
Yeah, basically. So for the folks who do recognize the name Russell Lord, it's probably for his work as the editor of the agricultural literary journal, The Lant, which I actually have a collection of, and I'm going to be reading it on a plane in like 12 hours. So highly recommend it. It does exist on Amazon as a collection.
Shout out Amazon.
Shout out Amazon, everyone. I repeat, Amazon, in case you've never heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
This magazine is really important for a number of reasons, not just because it was kind of this like mouthpiece for the permanent agricultural movement after the collapse from World War II, but also because of a number of things we're going to talk about in part two of this episode. So we're going to put a quick pin on that, but it is important. Be aware that it exists. At one point in his career, he was described as the country's foremost farm writer during the New Deal years. In a lot of ways, I feel like the work he was doing, I feel like we're kind of a little bit of a modern analog to that. Obviously, smaller reach. But like while we dip our toes into farming and agriculture on our own free time, we do kind of fill a lot of this void of like tying these different facets together. And I think that's, I think it's really interesting to kind of see how his career trajectory went and so on.
And I know we're on an audio medium, but I can literally see Andy's chest swell with pride and his head just slightly getting bigger, kind of like those old Airhead commercials.
Yeah, it's like Big Trouble in Little China when that dude implodes himself by swelling up. Things getting big.
Yeah, I'm ignoring both of you. Anyways, all I'm saying is, like, we'll be as big as a dude who doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, which is basically the only way you know if someone is important. That's all I'm saying. Russell Lord was born in Baltimore in 1895 and moved to Worthington Valley outside of Baltimore City's reach in the early 1900s. Now, his father was a part of that generation that we talked about before in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that was infatuated with moving back to the land, that the cities were getting too big, there's going to be food shortages, the world was going to collapse, like it was coming. In 1907, they moved to Iona, where they found a 58-acre farm, and that's where Russell would end up growing up. His father, Henry, was, again, one of those back-to-the-land people, and he never really had any exposure to farming as a human. The only exposure he'd had really was like magazines and books and like the Jeffersonian style essays about the loss of the rugged individualism and like the idea that we could all really be self-sufficient if we wanted to.
Man, that's just something you just never hear about anymore, huh? No one's talking about that.
Right? No one ever goes on and sees influencers talk about these things.
I mean, it sounds like a cool prequel to Into the Wild.
Into the Wild's the prequel. What would that be called? Just the Wild? No. Into the suburbs?
Mm-hmm.
Out of the suburbs?
I forget.
Into the Wilds.
What was he? Never mind. I don't know much about that guy.
Not important. He's not worth our time.
Not niche enough.
Chris Candles?
No way. Couldn't tell you. Now, Russell would later enroll in the first class of the first agricultural high school in the country, and it would be one of his first exposures to the diversity ideas of what agriculture could and theoretically should be. And of course, if you've been listening to this series in order, you'll know that was driven by the reform work of Liberty Hyde Bailey, who pushed to make rural communities modernize both their agricultural practices as well as their civic practices. And if you recall, Bailey had criticized the Back to the Land movement, arguing that it was framed within a, in quote, fear of immigrants, and a movement that, in quote, disregarded the realities of agricultural economics. He pointed to something that Lord would later on also talk about quite a bit, and that the idea of sustainable agriculture, permanent agriculture, and homesteading were antagonistic to one another, that they were actually not the same idea of the future, but actually fought with each other.
I mean, was he writing this last week? Because I feel like we've talked about this a lot.
It's a running theme for us, especially on social media. Now, to fully understand this time in history, we have to remember what was going on in the late 1800s. Again, we covered this a bit in the Liberty Hyde Bailey episode, but it's worth reiterating. You know, we have this movement from the Industrial Revolution, which was pushing for a bigger urban labor pool, which was being both fed by immigration and farmers moving to urban spaces as farming became less and less profitable.
A running theme here in America.
Now, pairing this with the 1893 Depression, which had ripped the economy open right before Russell's birth, and it pushed folks like his dad to want to move back to the country, which the government supported as concerns about having enough farmers, despite needing that labor pool in the cities, was a concern.
So the government backed the push for homesteaders and farmers in the late 1800s, but they also pushed for people to move to the cities too.
Yeah, it sounds like they needed bodies, Matt. They needed bodies to build the base of the pyramid, or I guess meat for the grinder. You know, choose your idiom.
Now, with Roosevelt's election in 1901 and his advocacy to restore America's agrarian greatness, he spoke both to the Country Life movement and the Back to the Land movement, for better or worse. The interdependence, even if you could call them maybe unequal, of these two movements would continue to be a thread that kind of tangled throughout Russell's life and kind of his vision for what ethical land stewardship and food systems should look like. And this still continues to this day through permaculture and homesteader turned farmers. And we'll be, like I said, we'll be diving into this a lot more. This is like the beginning of that conversation.
So like, what are the crops got left in the Dust Bowl? Are we talking like alfalfa or something? What? We don't grow a lot of stuff after that happened, right?
Tell me about the rabbits, George.
Lenny?
Yeah. Here at the Raytheon Technologies Corporation, we believe children are the future, just not the ones on the other end of our products. Like our RIM-7 Sea Sparrow anti-aircraft missile system, the most environmentally friendly anti-aircraft missile produced anywhere today. We're mindful of our environmental legacy here, which is why today we're introducing a new line of pollinator-friendly Stinger missiles. This lightweight, portable system includes a native wildflower mix that scatters upon impact. You're welcome, bees. Raytheon. Pack a punch, plant a bunch.
Within this context, Russell became intimate with both fields of thought, both at home and in school. And it was actually Russell himself who decided that he wanted to go to this agricultural high school. The new school offered a wide, extensive, complex, modern collection of classes in agriculture and science. And the classes were so good that they were basically treated and considered the same courses that freshmen at like Cornell's agricultural program received, which is what it was based on because, you know, Liberty Hyde Bailey was involved with both programs, so they were both his, like, vision of the future of agriculture. Part of Bailey's role with Cornell was to build scientific awareness for rural farmers, which he felt would be best done by educating farmers where they were, which was often not at college.
So it's like the rippling butterfly effect, but Liberty Hyde Bailey.
You mean the...
Don't do it.
Bailey fly effect?
No notes.
Exactly.
Just making stuff up.
Yeah. So the program at the agricultural high school was designed to prepare future farmers, not to just be, you know, cogs in a machine or the machine itself, but to understand farming holistically. Now, to Bailey, this meant classes weren't just about agricultural mechanics and engineering and agronomy, but arts, music, and one thing that was particularly important to Bailey was civic engagement. This was kind of a difficult position because students were graduating with really great qualifications to go to college, and they very easily could leave the rural communities for work, which was like the opposite of what the whole point of the program was, right? It was to make farmers more educated, not to get farmers off of the land because they were educated. For Russell, who was kind of a creative, you know, he became a journalist, so he was more creative than the typical farm kid. This was a really perfect fit for his interests. Not only did he excel in the agricultural courses, he was able to do tons of writing at the school paper. This was particularly important as his identity and understanding of agriculture grew, because he got to speak with one farmer named Marvin Oren. And this guy, Marvin, lived in an area known for poor soils, and he had discussed using different manure treatments to improve his yield. The guy was kind of eccentric and spent a lot of his free time doing various tests from his sheep's bones to wheat to anything he could really get his hands on and try to prove whether or not the different stuff he was doing was improving or making the soil worse. And in this article, Oren is quoted as saying, and quote, "Earth is the farmer's instrument. He plays upon it in the dark as best he can. The individual who undertakes to prescribe for the land and to see that his plants are fed their quota of mineral waters in the correct proportions may call his choices scientific, but he is still fumbling among mysteries unsolved," end quote. And this idea of farming and being humble and looking to nature for the answers, was really transformational for Russell and would influence his decision-making for the rest of his life.
Yeah, and his writing inspires a vision that there is a market for performance farming art. I can't see far enough into the future. I don't know how to tap into it yet, but we can get there.
You mean performance?
I mean, it's like those garden hermits that rich people used to hire, you know?
If anyone's rich and wants to hire a garden hermit, I know a guy. I'm looking at him right now.
I mean, I'll do it. I'll double as security.
There we go.
Yeah. Now, in 1912, Russell graduated along with the first class at Agricultural High School. Yes, the school was called Agricultural High School. So far in this podcast, we've talked about like three high schools, one of which was Normal High School, obviously Normal. And this one is Agricultural High School.
You're not talking about the Normal School again, are we?
We are. Sorry. Anyways, that was a little unnecessary rant. Now, as this class graduated, they were optimistic about being the best they could be because they were the first class of this new school. They're super educated. They have a new vision of what agriculture looks like. They're happy to engage with technology and mechanization. They're hyped, right? What's important is they fundamentally have a different relationship with what farming was versus their parents and the lived experiences of their parents who were all farmers. And that obviously like is something that happens. We all think we know better than our parents, but adding this new agency based on the education will eventually cause like issues with how farmers grow up and their relationship with traditional practices and their respect for traditional practices and their willingness to engage with new technologies.
And that's what we're here for, really, is to remind you that everything is contradictory. It's a core memory I have now adopted since the biochar episode. Is technology good?
Well, yes, except for when it's not. Then no. But sometimes it's bad until it's good.
Right. And then the good things are bad sometimes, but not when they're good.
Right. Like when the toaster works, but it keeps burning your toast.
Right. That's biochar.
Exactly.
I'm so proud of you both for making my brain fry like this.
You do it to us, man. This is reciprocal.
Yeah, it is.
A whole biochar production system based around toast. It's a dream come true.
It's full circle. The wheat becomes the char that feeds the wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bailey was worried, much like, you know, was watching these classes graduate, that a lot of these kids would end up going to college, which Russell was one of many who decided to go to college after graduation. Coincidentally, at the same time as he was going back to college, his father decided to move the family back to the Baltimore suburbs. And his father still had an interest in experimenting with farming, and he continued to invest in farms, but he never lived back on a farm after this. So Russell lived in this agricultural space for the same amount of time as his own dad, which is kind of interesting because like it clearly shaped his relationship with the world around him, even though it was like this small part of his dad's life.
Mm.
When Russell graduated, he actually followed the dean of the agricultural school to Berkeley. Part of this was because the dean wasn't very much appreciated as a very progressive person in these rural communities. And the fact that so many students did go off to college instead of staying on the farm didn't make him like the most liked person in the community. So it was kind of time to go.
So the dean caught a bunch of flack for educating kids enough to get the fuck off the farms.
Yeah, basically. Now, when Russell went to college, he was a part of this new class of students whose holistic agricultural education was quickly becoming kind of obsolete because of the development of technology and the application of technology and this idea of mechanizing agriculture instead of this more holistic understanding. For a college setting, agriculture was really driven by like chemistry and plant breeding and all these very technical understandings of agriculture, which he really wasn't prepared for. Now, part of this was because of the Smith-Lever Act of 1914, which really accelerated a lot of this movement, and it created the Cooperative Extension Service associated with each land grant institution. Now, we talked about the Smith-Lever Act a bit in, I think, part one of the three-parter we just finished up. So if you want more on that, go check that out. But by the time Russell finished his freshman year of college, he actually returned home. He realized that wasn't really what he wanted what he wanted to do. But what he was able to do was he took the year's worth of prerequisites that he'd had and decided to apply to Cornell, where he was able to enroll as a sophomore. And this is, for context, is about 20 years before Efraim Hernandez.
Man, it's cool to think about how all these like really important people overlapped or like almost overlapped. I think we talked about some other ones. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how a lot of them did have like the same college professors, or that their college professors were friends with Liberty Hyde Bailey, who was friends with so-and-so, who influenced the president in deciding blah, blah, blah. You know, all these names all kind of spin around each other in similar circles and end up kind of make us think about how easily history is changed by a handful of people, right? So like, a bigger context, you know, Liberty Hyde Bailey influenced Teddy Roosevelt's administration, and then a student through both his high school program, which was directed by the work of Roosevelt, and his college program that we just talked about at Cornell, and then Russell Lord will end up being an important voice in the FDR administration. And he was just like a kid from Maryland. You know what I mean?
It's almost like these people were placed in history and time. It's giving me big tinfoil hat vibes that this kind of coincidence isn't a coincidence, and that like all of this was planned. And if it weren't for, I guess it could be if it wasn't just, you know, farm nerds, I guess, going to school.
I think we ought to pivot this podcast, make it just all about really niche agricultural conspiracy theories.
Confarmacy?
I mean, that's part of performance art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, could be.
See, I did it, Andy. How do you like it?
I'm so proud of you, Elliot.
I hate myself.
Do you?
It was flawless.
Now, back to our good friend Russell. Now, while the courses at Cornell weren't fundamentally different than at Berkeley, it was a very big environmental shift. You know, it was much more optimistic. And while he was at school, he did spend a lot of time going back to his hometown, because obviously Cornell is a lot closer than Berkeley to Maryland. And even though his family had moved back to the suburbs, he was still really close to the farmers that were in the community where he'd grown up. He enjoyed, as we talked about as a journalist in high school, that he really enjoyed listening to their stories and listening to their knowledge. This, you know, was at odds with the fact that a lot of these extension schools quickly dismissed like this more older farmer knowledge, and that these extension schools were basically exist as like this nationalized system. And in many cases, as we'll talk, were underwritten by like large corporate agricultural interests, which is why they pushed for new investments in technology and really showed no interest in the knowledge that the farmers did have.
Yeah, and I feel like this is partially why every STEM subject has ethics involved in it now, isn't it?
I gotta say, given Mr. Musk, I feel like that didn't work. But then I remember he didn't actually graduate from college, so.
Well, quote, school is not a place for smart people, end quote. And that's fictitious Rick Sanchez. I'm fictitious Rick!
Nice. Now, it was clear at this point that industry defined the future of agriculture, and this was most obvious in agricultural school newspapers, such as the one at Cornell, where Russell not only attended, but worked as a contributor, assistant editor, managing editor, and even editor-in-chief. In a lot of ways, he was following a lot of the same footsteps that Liberty Hyde Bailey had to this point. The front half of each newspaper that he oversaw was filled with the newest developments in agricultural technologies, from tools to pesticides and breeding and everything in between.
Yeah, and it really is giving me like flashbacks to the Efraim episode. It really does place them as contemporaries, that last little bit there.
It's basically version 1.0 of what Efraim saw happen.
Now, as 1917 rolled forward and President Woodrow Wilson addressed Americans with what was called a, in quote, a call to farms.
God, he's as bad as you.
What you're saying is that I should be president. I think
no,
that's what you're saying.
That's not what I'm saying.
That's what I heard. Elliot?
It couldn't get any worse. I don't give a shit anymore.
See, that is an astounding support. Like, that'll be my bumper sticker. Fuck it. Can't get any worse.
Can't get any worse. I don't give a shit anymore.
I don't give a shit anymore. So we've got this call to farms as World War One is erupting, and this would kind of change the relationships between farmers and the extension schools forever. I want to dig into this a little bit because it highlights a lot of what we're going to be kind of talking about in this episode and the next episode. In this issue that had Wilson's address, it rallied students to both farm every inch of soil on campus, and it motivated students to sign up for the military. In it, Liberty Hyde Bailey released a small piece in which she advocated, in quote, "Its principle of union will be the love of the earth, treasured in the hearts of men and women. To every person who longs to walk on the bare ground, who stops in a busy day for the song of a bird, who hears the wind, who looks up to the clouds, who would protect the land from waste and devastation, realizing that we are transients and the multitudes must come after us, who would exercise a keepership over the planet, who would love the materials and yet not be materialistic, who would contribute his skill and his excellence to the common good, who would escape self-centered commercial and physical valuations of life, to all these souls everywhere the call will come."
Common good. I mean, that sounds awfully communist for so-called freedom-loving Americans.
Yeah, and like we discussed in the Bailey episode, he wasn't really a capitalist or a communist, but he definitely had a flavor of like communal solidarity. This is something that we've seen echoed throughout this permanent agriculture movement, right? And these words, again, much like his good buddy Marvin, would stick with Russell for the remainder of his life. And it really speaks to something that we'll see in Russell's work with that magazine, The Land. And basically, one of the things we have to remember about Bailey that Russell kind of picked up the torch from was this idea of unorganized and democratic association. The Society for the Friends of the Land, which backed The Land magazine, was based on this idea. And before we go further, we're going to take a quick break.
Hey, we're taking a quick break in the episode to remind you that you can get a whole lot more information from poorproles.com. On our website, we have access to our supplemental reader for the podcast, which provides more depth and context, as well as thorough citations for all of the stuff we talk about in the show. You can also sign up for our newsletter, which updates you about limited releases, such as various nursery stock that we sometimes sell through the Poor Proles website, as well as updates about new merch that we have. You can also support the show through that website, poorproles.com, where you have access to our Patreon and our Substack to get early releases for articles and episodes. Now, if you enjoy the show and are just looking for even more audio content, go check out Tomorrow Today, which just wrapped up season one, or tune into The Gastropocene, which is a project of myself and Dr. Aisha Khan to discuss the way our diets have driven the Anthropocene and what it looks like to use our diets for good. Now, back to the show.
Now, during the summers in college, he worked as a milk inspector in Northern Maryland from 1915 to 1917. Farmers and other hands complained about the unnecessary inspections, and Russell saw firsthand the impacts of both lack of scientific education, as well as the capacity of agricultural interests to fight for food safety science. So while he respected a lot of these farmers, he understood why the other side existed. Now, as the Great War drove demand for American milk higher and higher, the increasing cost of fertilizers to grow feed began to overwhelm a lot of farmers, and folks like Professor E.S. Savage, who doesn't get as much appreciation as Bailey, but Savage and Liberty Hyde Bailey started discussing the benefits of returning to permanent agriculture, a term that we've brought up a number of times now, but was actually coined by Liberty Hyde Bailey in the early 1900s.
Societal history repeats itself in cycles of about 30 and 90 years. So I feel like we've been here before, and I we're doomed to be here again.
Yeah. It flows.
Yeah, we got that 30-year flow. It's beautiful. Now, in late 1917, Russell enlisted in the army. His time in service invariably, again, what I feel like I keep saying, changed the course of his life as he understood the war as the price to pay for advanced technologies. In his words, in quote, "If mechanization is the price of progress, what was the alternative?"
It seems like he's changed the course of his life a lot. Like, he never got out of that college student phase where you just keep switching back and forth to whatever you're interested in. I don't know. When does he grow up and be an adult and work a job that he hates?
And just settle and be miserable?
Yeah. When's that happen?
It's coming. So Lord was sent to France awaiting orders.
They sent the Lord to France. Oh, geez.
I'm not sure where Jesus was at this time. He's probably just hanging around like he's known to do. But I feel like him and the Lord together would have been a little too much, even for France.
While waiting to move to the front lines, the soldiers were given permission to assist local farmers with the harvest. Of course, this was like putting him in his element, right? He noticed that the soil was managed entirely different than it was at home, that the hillsides and slopes were carefully terraced, they were maintained by generations of farmers, and a lot of these farms had existed for over 700 years. He noted that the soil was made rich because of the way amendments including compost, manures, and winter cover crops were applied. He noticed that there was apples and grapes and sweet hay and sweet potatoes and corn. And all these came from hundreds of small fields that were kind of a patchwork across the landscape. And they were managed and protected by, you know, these thousand-year-old hedges and these ancient stone walls and the idyllic scenery that we think of for, like, old farmlands, right? But they were still producing and productive and healthy. Now, on August 25th, 1918, 39 days after arriving, and still without getting guns or horses, they were moved even closer to the front. They were actually scheduled to arrive at the front on November 10th, a day after the abdication of Kaiser Wilhelm II and the end of the Great War. So he managed to escape actually going to the war, even though he was going to the front lines with no guns.
Oh, man. Skin of his teeth.
Yeah. Skin of his teeth. And his unit was returned back to Maryland in March of 1919. And by May 27th, he was no longer in service.
Wow, it sounds like the Lord got a little blessed there.
Truly.
It's almost like he blessed himself. Mm-hmm. After returning home, Russell began to teach in the agricultural extension programs. And he tried to work as a freelance journalist, working specifically as a farm journalist in Ohio. During this time, he became really intimately aware of the destruction of the soils because he was going there as a journalist. He knew that these were once some of the most fertile soils in the country. So, like, they'd been destroyed within, you know, a few generations. Now, we had talked briefly about this area on the Merino sheep episode because this was where all the farmers went after the Northeast had been destroyed in the early 1800s.
And I believe that's our third callback for the episode. So if you haven't listened to those episodes that we've referenced, why don't you go back and do that and drop a like and tell all your friends and family about it.
Hell yeah.
This time Elliot's doing the Lord's work. Fucking marketing. Can't just be memes.
God, I hope not. You know, I've been thinking about pricing up billboards.
And that
can imagine
be
putting
fun.
Memes on billboards? Mm. Like, instead of meme lords, we got meme boards.
What about a giant billboard, but it's just a scrolling TikTok feed to distract drivers?
What could go wrong?
Yeah, I was going to vandalize some Chick-fil-A billboards just to get free stuff.
There you go. Speaking of free things, the Roaring Twenties kicked in, right? And, like, everything was good, and nothing bad ever happened again, right? The 20s were great. It was perfect, and things just went up, right?
Yeah, there's no reason to question that, and flappers are great for everyone.
Despite everything being perfect and everything was awesome forever, he did notice there was some tension growing between farmers where he worked. So in, like, Ohio's Allegheny Plateau, the government was pushing these extension programs, which were largely bankrolled by industry. Now, his own position was to provide support in rural communities to help county agents contribute to independent and community newspaper stories. And the idea was to provide some unbiased information around modernizations on the farm. As he watched these farmers, like, very quickly adopt things like monocrop plantations to feed the commodity industry, he realized very quickly that it was neither sustainable nor was it meeting the self-fulfillment that farmers wanted from their own work. After the war, the price supports were restructured that had kept farmers afloat, and many farmers were left without any markets to sell their produce in. So they were trying to produce more, and there was no place to sell them. Very quickly, most of the country's land prices collapsed, and farms were heavily consolidated. Now, while the soil did need rest after these hard years during the war, a lot of farmers tried to work the land even harder to make up for the fact that, like, shrinking margins had basically made it impossible to make money, while also dealing with the fact that their inputs were doubling. And many times, farms that had been in families for, like, generations had to be sold, and many of those farmers actually ended up going to work back on their own farm, but instead as tenants instead of owners.
Brutal.
Yeah, so this is one of those times where you see the decisions that are made, and when they're not sustainable, it brings you down at the other end of that bell curve. And we always talk about complex systems and how things need to be cyclical. So when you go against it, you end up at the bottom, and this is where depressions and things come from.
Shout out to depression.
Shout out depression.
It's my side bitch.
you guys know that that's a song?
Is it?
Yeah. We should listen to it after it.
What's a song?
I think it's called I Got Depression, but it's like a rap song.
Okay. Sounds like self-diagnosis, but we'll carry on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So during this period of unfettered success where everyone was winning except for the farmers, the cities were continuing to grow. They were having this great moment of prosperity. Middle class was growing, yada, yada, yada. It became very clear that the agricultural sector was going to continue to struggle. And at the same time, it was destroying the thing that made it wealthy, the soil, in a hope to not struggle. So it was destroying its piggy bank while not getting anything in return. As he traveled across Ohio, he realized that as he was talking to all these extension agents, it became rarer and rarer to actually hear any success stories for farmers outside of like the very heavily capital backed farms for basically the 1%, right? After 3 years of doing this and being frustrated, he actually resigned. The populism of the farmers that also were frustrated with how agriculture was going was speaking to this undercurrent that distrusted the agricultural interest groups and monopolies that claimed to speak for them. So if you recall, in the early 20th century, there was a lot of organizations that sprung up to defend farmers, and most of them were pretty progressive, but some of them were very right wing, and those were the ones that usually had the most money backing them. And as we saw and we discussed, those movements continued into the 20s, and that's what we're talking about right here. You know, we had things like the Grange and the National Farmers Union, which protested the influences of extension agents. And then there were organizations like the Ohio Farm Bureau, which were basically mouthpieces for corporate interests.
I mean, I just think it's funny that around this time, like the government basically agreed. Well, we had our prohibition episode, but all of this, like the farmers are getting bent over. And then it just reminded me of the quote from Harold and Kumar, where he's like, you ever tried farming not high, or I guess drunk? It's boring as shit. So they banned booze and it just made everything worse. But back to what we're talking about, like the Grange and the National Farmers Union, they were kind of left-wing groups in the late 1900s, right? So they were steering in that direction.
So there were voices for them, but as the government realized, like, they could pull back because farming was succeeding as these bigger farmers were, that was in quotes, as these bigger farmers were still being able to be profitable, even though they were putting out, every small farmer was going out of business. They started to do things like cut back salaries for extension agents and allowed those corporate organizations like the Ohio Farm Bureau to kind of step in and subsidize and monopolize support services, basically selling corporate solutions for any agricultural issues while under the guise of being like from the government, even though they were not. Between the organizations you brought up and the work of like Henry Wallace, who we talked about again the last couple episodes, before he became the vice president and into politics, he actually wrote was writing this thing called Wallace's Farmer. And he was also disgusted with what was happening. He also resigned around the same time as Lord. After he resigned, this is around the same time he married who would be his wife, Kate Kalkman. Now, after his resignation and his marriage, Russell landed a writing position with Crowell Publishing, which owned the popular magazine Farm and Fireside. Russell was responsible for reporting on, again, his sweet spot, success stories in farming, which he never finds. And he would say, you know, one of his quotes is, I found a few outstanding farm families here and there with two cars and a bathroom. Most of them were fine people. I wrote about them, but little by little, the fact bit into me that they hadn't made it in farming. They had made it as topsoil miners and salesmen as a rule. Through a curious combination of ignorance, innocence, greed, and need, they were selling America and our future down the river. And here I was, a Park Avenue farm reporter, taking as much as $500 an article to celebrate their successes as farmers. It didn't make sense.
So he was writing about the farmers who had found, like, little bits of land that hadn't been destroyed. I was expecting him to find only farmers that were some kind of, like, gimmick, like Joel Salatin-y type.
I mean, instead, it's just holdouts and late adopters and people who had money to stay afloat until they could pivot and make more money, which is, that's a thing here in America.
It is. With this new job, instead of just being in Ohio, he was traveling the country. It became very clear to him that rural communities across the country were all in the same place. They were all on the brink of collapse. Government policies to reduce land and production were failing, and Russell saw a lot of this firsthand. Now, when he got back to New York, where he lived during this time with Crowell Publishing, soon to be governor of New York, Franklin D. Roosevelt, name you might recognize, was advocating for a permanent agriculture inspired by Liberty Hyde Bailey's work and introduced a massive program to purchase and reforest wasted lands. The goal was to put these newly owned lands into public ownership for conservation management and to help displaced farmers work as conservation workers.
I mean, that honestly sounds just like such a cool concept. Keep farmers doing like similar labor while reducing output, allowing for the other farmers to be more profitable while also, you know, doing cool ecology work, and this, you know, being for the benefit of public ownership.
I mean, it sounds good in theory, but could you imagine the government getting their hands on that now?
True.
They'd be like, no, this mountain needs more dynamite. It's what nature calls for.
No, this mountain still has a top on it.
Everyone knows we want topless mountains. This is America.
Mm-hmm.
Unsurprisingly, the fact that you guys are not familiar with this story and this project of FDR's points to the fact that much of this never got put into action. And we did cover some of the FDR stuff in the last few episodes. But what's important to understand is that at this particular time, the president, President Hoover, didn't really see eye to eye with Roosevelt. Now, while Hoover would try to do some stuff around agriculture, from price fixing and a number of other things, nothing really worked. Eventually, the advertising revenues for Farm and Fireside plummeted, and the magazine was reinvented as the Country Home, and that was a fashion monthly.
The cottagecore. We're back around another 80 years.
We are.
90 years.
But there was no farming in this cottagecore. So 34-year-old Russell Lord was once again shifting his career, and he joined Fortune magazine as a freelance reporter to write about the impacts of farm regulations, which demanded farmers to reduce production as the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl began to unfold. Yeah, it's time to talk about the Dust Bowl.
Woo!
Yeah. It was also during this time when he was writing for Fortune magazine that he happened to run into Henry Wallace, who would 4 years later be Secretary of Agriculture under FDR.
Man, we just keep bringing up the same names and the same contemporaries, and this is just the beginning, because the overlaps get pretty interesting later on as the story unfolds, and we'll get into it.
We haven't even gotten to the the Hadron Collider, or am I saying that right?
The Hadron Collider.
The Hadron Collider with the squirrel.
What?
Or not the squirrel, the fucking mongoose or whatever the fuck it was.
Talking about the dude from Ice Age?
No.
What?
You guys don't know about this? The Hadron.
There was a mongoose in a Hadron Collider.
I know what the Hadron Collider is. I don't know anything about squirrels in it though. If you put a squirrel in it.
Oh my god, hold on.
Did they put a squirrel in it? Because that sounds fucking crazy.
Yeah.
No, one accidentally went in it.
Imagine
and they,
particle accelerating a squirrel.
And they thought that we are in an alternate timeline, which explains so much.
What, after the squirrel was particle accelerated?
Yes, weasel, that's what it was.
We're now in a new timeline.
I feel like we've talked about this on the show.
No.
Weasel apparently shuts down world's most powerful collider.
Praxis.
But there's like a theory that it put us into an alternate dimension, which makes a lot of sense because it was in 2017. And like, I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of really fucking weird and bad shit has happened since 2017.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people always talk about Harambe being the trigger, right?
Oh my God. I wonder how close this was to Harambe.
Boys, this was August, revering.
April 29th, 2016. When did Harambe die? May 28th, 2016. 8 weeks later.
Oh my god, I'm getting the fucking tinfoil,
tinfoil
boys.
Tinfoil hats, dude. The conspiracy is...
we found the true trigger.
Started here. News
article accelerated a goddamn weasel. And now... Yes.
R.I.P. in peace, Harambe.
I wonder if we'll have people look back at history and, like, choose that moment with this weasel. As, like, labeling peak prosperity.
Yeah, we could definitely get
the end of peak prosperity. You know,
it's like that lines, yeah, is when they particle accelerated a weasel and shot a gorilla.
Listen, that weasel was a covert agent. I'm telling you, we've been here before. That's where the saying comes from, you weasel.
Oh my god.
It's just gonna keep happening. Time is a flat circle.
Yeah. You heard it here first, folks. Time is a
back to Russell Lord and the not weasel.
How?
pulling this back.
No segue. Just get back into
it. No segue. Let's get in it. Get in it. Going raw.
Let's not leave.
He had the opportunity to meet Henry Wallace, right? And that same day, he also met a man named M.L. Wilson. Now, Wilson's an interesting fellow because he had spent a lot of his time, his career, with the Cree and Blackfoot farmers that practiced dryland farming. And this was like revolutionary to white people, right? These techniques would be amplified by Russell's work, who'd write about them. And eventually Wilson would actually land a position in FDR's team of whatever, his cabinet, as an agricultural figure only a few years later because of Russell Lord writing about him.
Yep. So two initial name obviously must be important in science. Takes indigenous practices, and everybody calls him a genius.
True.
Yes.
It's the immortal science.
The immortal science of two-lettered white people.
Mm-hmm. They're like, let me try say that again.
At this point, Russell had already collected a national awareness because he was this kind of famous journalist. And farmers, backyard gardeners, and policymakers all read the work that he was writing. He had this very multifaceted audience that was paying attention to him. He'd published a number of books, plus his articles in Farm and Fireside. He was writing pieces for Vanity Fair. He was working with The New Yorker. And he was probably the best known person advocating for a new ethic around land relations. And he framed it in this scientific agrarianism that really paired this idea of ecological health with farm and ultimately human health. He had connected with like radical economists and agronomists from J.R. Commons to M.L. Wilson, who we just mentioned. You know, like Commons would go on to become a household name in defense of labor. And Wilson obviously became a very big figure in alternatives to conventional agriculture. Russell was able to leverage his massive audience and connections to pitch a simple argument that food production ties to local conditions. I think it's about at this point we should take a break. And next week, we'll pick up with his involvement with the Roosevelt administration, the Friends of Land, and a whole lot more.
Okay, so as always, it's going to take us a few episodes. Well, at least it'll take us this one episode to sort of set the table. And then next episode, we're going to eat.
Hell yeah.
We're going to eat.
And we're also going to dive more into this peak prosperity timeline overlap. That's a promise.
Matt's going to look up everything that's happened since that fucking weasel was in that collider.
Yeah, we need to figure out how the weasel got in there in the first place. That's where it starts, man.
It materialized in there.
Who dug the hole?
It's from an alternate timeline.
Sent back in time, dude. I'm just picturing a weasel with like a scouter on. Like,
He obviously looks like Scrat, but a weasel form. Like, obviously.
Oh, yeah, true. I was thinking
Scrat was his predecessor. Scrat started the Ice Age. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it just keeps happening.
I was thinking
the Ice Age starts again.
The rat from Kim Possible with the little glasses.
It was a mole rat. Yeah. What was his name?
I don't know. Anyways, if you guys enjoyed this episode and you want to hear part two, you can. I just can't wait. It's already up on Patreon. So $2 a month keeps our microphones on for better or worse. And you can read this whole piece by subscribing to our Substack. And that one's free. Part two is not, but the first one is.
I guess we're just going to do some research on weasels, and I'm going to keep looking at those Chick-fil-A billboards. It's a whole bunch of empty white space on there. Definitely get a PPA logo up on one of those.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. Donate so we can get a billboard, and we'll just put Elliot's fucking face right on it.
Oh, co-branding.
Yes. With like a big brand, like sign next to him that just says, "Who funded the weasel?" And then we're going to buy the website.
True.
HadronColliderWeasel.com.
It would be like a split billboard, but horizontally.
Yep, and I'll also need bail money, so please, please subscribe to our Patreon.
Preemptively need bail money.
Patreon's now jail support.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
Peace.
Later.